Well, now, one of pop culture's famous references to psychotherapy is Tony Soprano talking to Dr. Jennifer Melfi.
Where are your sisters in all this?
Oh, they cut it off with her a long time ago. No way she's bunking with them.
So you're carrying all this guilt when your mother is clearly someone who has great difficulty in maintaining a relationship with anyone.
But she's my mother. You're supposed to take care of your mother. She's a little old lady.
Not to you. She's very powerful.
Bullshit.
Tony Soprano and Dr. Jennifer Melfi, one of the key relationships in that long-running Sopranos. It's one of the early scenes there. Our guest is New Zealand's only professor of psychotherapy, Keith Tudor. He's received the prestigious International Eric Byrne Memorial Award for his work in the field of transactional analysis. It's a theory that helps explain why we think, act and feel the way we do, examining the three ego states we adopt in relating to each other, whether it be taking or designating, albeit subconsciously, the position of parent, adult or child, to better understand ourselves by analysing our transactions with the people closest to us. Keith is based at the Auckland University of Technology, where he pioneers co-creative transactional analysis, which includes an examination of how we might strengthen and even repair personal and working relationships, especially during current times of stress and uncertainty. Psychotherapy hasn't always had the most positive representation in popular culture or the media, and Keith isn't necessarily a fan of The Sopranos.
I'm ambivalent. It's a great way to start an interview with a therapist, isn't it? I feel a bit ambivalent about the Sopranos. I quite a fan of, you know, The Godfather, so I can handle violent Italian mafia films. I do think it was a step up. A lot of the media representations that had gone before Sopranos had psychotherapists usually in some sort of isolated storyline, and they were either, you know, Dr. Wonderful or Dr. Evil, or often transgressing boundaries, you know, seductive psychotherapists and so on. So certainly Dr. Melfi was a step up, and I do think that it gave people an insight into a more real contemporary sort of view of what psychotherapy does. And I think that in how she helped him dealing with feelings, symbols, you know, the ducks. He was very concerned and obsessed with the ducks. She interpreted that. And so I think there was a lot that was good about it. The bits that I didn't like were that she also crossed boundaries by, you know, greeting him in the restaurant and being slightly flirtatious. And one of the worst bits was that her supervisor would talk about him over dinner with his friends, which is completely, you know, just not what a supervisor would do. So I think that was some of the problems with it.
That's what shouldn't happen anyway.
What
is at the essence of psychotherapy then? Because we have all these terminologies. What's the difference, say, between, okay, let's say psychoanalysis and psychotherapy? They both begin with the same letters. But what is what is particular about psychotherapy that makes it different from other forms of therapy, or gets to the heart of what it's about?
Yeah, well, I like to keep things quite simple, and I'm also an academic, and I go back and study words and so on, and the meaning of the word psychotherapy translates from the Greek as soul healing, and so I see psychotherapy about healing the soul, however we define the soul. And I rather like that definition because it gets us away from just being a mind, or, you know, a thinking being, or just a body. And it has, to me, a sort of more holistic view of the being. And I also think that it allows for integration with, say, indigenous healing traditions, which tend to prioritize ideas about soul and spirit and connection with land and so on. So I think that that's different from psychoanalysis, which is, as its name suggests, is a particular analysis of the psyche and has a particular view about how that develops and how the unconscious is structured and so on. So I think psychotherapy is broader than psychoanalysis. And I also think that it it predates psychoanalysis. It comes from healing traditions that are older than psychoanalysis. It comes from medicine, going back to, you know, ideas about melancholia, psychiatry, academia, lay practice, ministry, and so on. So I think I would say psychoanalysis is a form of psychotherapy. Probably my psychoanalytic colleagues would say it came before psychotherapy.
Yeah. Is it essentially at its heart talk therapy?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And so, go ahead.
No, I was going to say it absolutely talk therapy, and very much based on the relationship between the client and the therapist. That's the vehicle for change.
So then let's talk about the area of transactional analysis. And we should say you've won this prestigious international award, the Eric Byrne Memorial Award. What was his particular strand or innovation in this field that clearly has become something of a focus for you?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you. The award is a great honour, and I should say it was co-won. So I want to acknowledge my co-conspirator, Graham Summers, with whom I wrote the original article on co-creative transactional analysis in 2000. So it's been lovely to get that acknowledgement from my sort of main professional community. Eric Byrne was a Canadian-American psychiatrist who originally trained in psychoanalysis, and then was rejected on sort of the last hurdle, and so sort of went away and founded his own form. And as the name suggests, he was interested in the analysis of transactions between people. So he was essentially interested in social psychology, in communication theory. And he was quite pragmatic. He was a U.S. Army doctor who had to assess people coming out of the army, and he had about 2 minutes to assess them. So he got very quick at being able to identify what their style of communication was and what that said about their personality. And he was famous for saying, if you can't cure your patient in the first session, then go home and think and figure out how to cure them in the second session. So that gives you an idea of his pragmatism. And he was, if you like, wanting to translate psychoanalysis into lay language. So a Freudian concept of repetition compulsion, which even sounds quite difficult to get a head around, he translated as psychological games people play, which was a bestseller. He wrote a book on it and it was a bestseller in the 1960s. So he was very interested in making perhaps rather complex ideas accessible to people. He was very interested in, he was quite a humanitarian. He when he was working as a psychiatrist in some of the closed psychiatric wards, he quite radically for the time, created a thing called the Staff Patient Case Conference, where instead of the patients being excluded from conversations that staff had about them, he would have them in the room, and then he would reverse the sort of seating arrangement so that the patients sat in the middle and the staff had to sit out, you know, around the outside and be quiet and listen to the patients talking about themselves. So he was quite an egalitarian. And that comes out, I think, in contemporary TA.
So where did he head away from the Freudian analysis and psychotherapy side of things? You mentioned he was interested in how the relationship or communication or transactions would happen with others. Was that different in that Freud was all about what was motivating what you were doing, thinking, behaving? It was more internal.
Yeah, that's a great summary. I couldn't have put it better. So I think, yes, Freud was more concerned with the intrapsychic and, interpreting that and in terms of where that came from. Byrne, I would say, probably balanced his interest in the intrapsychic with the interpersonal. So in terms of the analysis of transactions, it would be what's going on here now and what have you just said, and if I interrupted you, what did that mean, or, you know, and sort of clearing that out of the way as a representation of what's happening internally. So, you know, if we suddenly find ourselves getting very frustrated with somebody and it sort of comes out of nowhere, you know, that's probably to do with something that's going on internally with me. But what you see and what you can analyse is the external manifestation of that.
So how do we then get to these ego states, parent, child, adult? I mean, in some ways it can be quite instinctive to infer that our behaviours might come in some instances from what we were modelled, or in others from the insecurities that we felt as a child. But as a matter of academic research and study, how were those three ego states determined, I guess?
Yeah. I think he... Again, this shows some of Byrne's Freudian backgrounds, because there are there's some connection between that and the Freudian ideas of, you know, superego, id and ego, although they don't quite map onto each other. But I think when you mention the word intuitive, that's also very intuitive. And Byrne was, you know, it's a great metaphor. I think it was in this spirit of wanting to translate things into sort of lay language. He wrote a book called The Layperson's Guide to Psychiatry and Psychoanalysis, I think, at one point. So I think this idea that, yes, we, if you like, our personality is comprised of, if you like, three aspects, one of which is that sort of the stuff that we take in from parents that's interjected and held and stored, and we might reproduce that in a gesture that is, you know, like my father was a teacher, and, you know, I might have a gesture that I sort of copied from him, as it were, and that's fairly unconscious, and that's the parent stuff, if you like, sort of parallel to that, the child ego state would be those experiences that I had as a child that are old. And there are also different, I should say, there are different views about ego states within transactional analysis, because you can just imagine after about 6 years of transactional analysis, there are often sort of internal differences about how we interpret ego states. But I would see these ego states, the parent as the sort of interjected stuff that's unresolved, and the child as the archaic stuff that's unresolved, and the adult is the more present-centered, you know, all singing, all dancing, operating part of our personality that has integrated those past experiences or those past parental inferences.
When have been the eras where transactional analysis have become very popular or very common? The obvious one to point to is the I'm OK, You're OK, Thomas A. Harris book, What was its impact?
I think it had enormous impact at the time. But the problem was that Harris reversed some of Byrne's fundamental ideas. So whereas Byrne said that he thought everybody was born okay in a sort of rather like a blank screen, you know, but essentially, you know, positive and directional and so on, Harris reversed that and said we were born not okay and that we became okay through good parenting. But nevertheless, I think the Harris's book did popularize TA, and I think therein lies part of the problem, is that it almost became too associated with the pop culture, and so it's seen in some circles as a bit lightweight and a bit, you know, oh, it's just about being okay and having things nice, rather than it being, you know, a serious analysis of transactions at lots of levels, not only between two people, but say within an organization or a group or even society. So I think, the popularization of TA in the early mid-70s was also a bit of a problem for us.
So let's come to your work. And you said published in 2000, the work that's in focus here, which is co-creative transactional analysis. What is it about?
Well, I think on a personal level, it was about a way of Graham, as I say, Graham Summers and myself, finding our own way with TA, because for various reasons, I'd sort of moved a bit away from TA, and I'd been concentrating more on Rogerian person-centered psychology and counselling and psychotherapy, establishing a training institute and so on. And I thought if I was going to stay sort of associated with TA and indeed become a teaching and supervising transactional analyst, which I am, that's my sort of status within TA, I had to sort of make my own way with it. And so co-creative TA was a sort of rereading of TA from a more contemporary perspective, drawing on ideas from Kurt Lewin in the 50s about field theory, about the importance of context, about the way that we construct things, the way we construct ideas about, you know, gender, for instance. And so we offered a rereading of TA, which I think makes it more contemporary and particularly focusing on what gets co-created. So, for instance, I was nervous before, you know, coming online, and there's something, you know, in your voice, which I'm familiar with from the radio, that's reassuring. So part of my calmness has been co-created by our interactions so far. So it's not just about me separately or you separately. It's about what's co-created between us.
And is that applied then in therapy, which is obviously critical because there is the client and there is the therapist. Is that where this is focused, or is it focused more generally on human interactions?
No, within the, well, I'd say both. I'd say to start with, in terms of the interaction between the therapist and the client, co-creative TA is particularly interested in what gets co-created in the relationship. And in a recent article that was published last year, I identified other qualities of this, which were that they were, you know, what emerges is conversational, it's emergent, it's improvised, it's uncertain. You don't quite know what's going to emerge from a session, either as the client or as the therapist, when you go into that. You've, in a way, got to sort of hold, I think, a particular outcome lightly, you know, because if you're working with the relationship, then you have to allow the relationship to emerge. I would also say that that works on a wider level. So, for instance, in a group or in an organisation, those qualities are equally important.
What is it that you are trying to achieve, either in a person's own circumstance or in a professional group, say? Are you trying to teach people to recognise those ego states and they can change in the course of an interaction? Recognise them in order to manage responses? What is it that you're trying to achieve?
Yeah, I think the aim of TA, as far as Byrne was concerned, was to maximise autonomy. So people's, if you like, self-determination, self-responsibility, freedom to act. I think that's a little bit individualistic. So I would pair that up with the concept that I came across some years ago called homonymy, which describes our urge to belong. So I think that we have two things going on. One is that we do like to be quite individual and, you know, I like to do my own thing and have my study, you know, organized in the way that I want it. But I also have a desire to belong and to engage with others and maybe to be part of a group and to subsume my individuality to that. So I think I'm helping clients, people to navigate those desires, those motivations, if you like, drives. And I think the parent-adult-child model is a useful metaphor for understanding that. It's a handy reference point, but it's not the only metaphor. So to be frank, I'm more focused on the analysis of transactions than I am on saying, oh, that's your parent or that's your child. So I'm not trying to teach people about that. It's, as I say, I think it's a useful, handy, intuitive metaphor. But essentially, I'm trying to help people navigate their way through, you know, complex and increasingly complex world, and particularly in the current circumstances, in a way that acknowledges both their, if you like, their individuality, but also their sort of sense of collectivity.
So what are the kinds of tools, is probably not the right word, but like, you can do, in the context of a conversation, you can do some guiding and some leading of people, I guess. But in the end, do you want them to leave with the ability to do things for themselves? Like what is it that you want people to be able to do when they have finished with their therapy?
Well, I suppose this sort of gets to the heart when you say it's not about necessarily about techniques and so on. I want them to be freer or free from the constraints they came in with. And so in a sense, they can decide what their aims are. They can decide what defines cure. They can decide what, you know, feeling better is. Some people may go away feeling more anxious because actually that is more present to them rather than suppressing it. Somebody
does that
else.
Often happen with therapy? Sorry to interrupt you, Keith. I'm curious about that. Do you often feel worse before you feel better? And is that quite a common trajectory?
Absolutely. I think it, particularly for long-term therapy, I think, and I don't think therapy has to be long-term, but I think it is a trajectory. You definitely, certainly in terms of my own experience of therapy, which I've done over the years since quite a long time ago, there's been times when I felt worse, but I suppose I've had a sense that the trajectory is up, but there might be a sort of dip. There might be a break in, you know, I might be in a difficult relationship that I need to get out of and need support in that, and so on. So I think, yeah, there is a bit of pain before gain. But I think the key thing is helping people to decide, in a sense, what their measures are. And so this is different from something like, you know, solution-focused therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy that, you know, in a sense, only focuses on cognition and behavior. I know some of my CBT colleagues will disagree with me about that. But, you know, it's essentially that you're saying, what's the behavior that's problematic? And, you know, here are some techniques to change it. I'm taking probably a more philosophical stance and saying, and what are the advantages and disadvantages of that behavior? And, you know, what is it that you want at the end, rather than me defining the cure. So in a sense, each psychotherapy and each psychotherapy relationship is bespoke.
Is it always about behaviour? What are the role of feelings and emotions? Because often people might say they want help because they feel bad, or very often because they feel stuck. What are the range of pains, if I can put it that way, that might bring someone to therapy?
Oh, well, the world's our oyster. Overwork, alienation, dissatisfaction, feeling too responsible, not feeling responsible enough, as well as, you know, the usual anxieties, depression, and so on. So I think it's a whole range of things. And I think it's important to except that there are, I suppose I want to be even-handed. You know, people sometimes sort of talk about, psychotherapy is only for the worried well. Well, no, I don't agree with that. But also, that minimizes the worry of the worried well. You know, so I think that psychotherapy does appeal to people at the sort of, sort of heavy end of the spectrum, almost sort of people who might be in psychiatric hospital. And I think, you know, there's evidence that psychotherapy is effective in dealing with things like, you know, depression and even, you know, personality disorders. But I also think that, take the current situation where people are feeling incredibly anxious. I think particularly during the second period of, you know, alert level 3, I've seen, you know, anxiety states go up and people really struggling with uncertainty. And this is something that, you know, psychotherapy can help with and actually is helping with, because most psychotherapists are now working online because they're also, you know, locked down.
So how can it help with uncertainty, which is, look, it's the human condition to some extent anyway. It's Professor Paul Wood who said that, the idea that we have control over our lives is a mirage anyway. It's just some of us can get away with thinking that for a while and others can't. But this is in-your-face uncertainty where you can't even pretend that you have control over your life.
No,
and what is it that we most need, however we go about it? What does the human being need in faced with an uncertainty over just about everything, or even a lack of clarity over what might be?
Yes, absolutely. And even the anxiety about the lack of clarity, you know, about what alert level 2 means this time, those sort of things that are very contemporary. Well, I think two things. One is I think that we would do better to embrace the idea that we are open to change. You know, we have these aphorisms like, you know, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And yet we also know from neuroscience, neuroscience is telling us, you know, that the brain has a plasticity and, you know, that we can rebuild, you know, damaged neural pathways. So you can teach an old dog new tricks. And I think one of the things I've always been puzzled about and I've struggled a little bit with is that I'm quite open to change. And yet I see some of my colleagues in psychotherapy being pretty stubborn or sort of closed, if you like, to you know, new ideas and so on. So I think generally if we could sort of promote the idea that we are changing beings, you know, we are changing beings, as an organism, our cells change, our gut lining gets replaced every 7 days or whatever it is. So that's one thing. And the other thing is that I think that uncertainty is the new competence. I think we need, you know, we talk about different competences, relational competences, and I think we are inevitably having to get our heads around the idea that we do need to embrace uncertainty. You know, the only certainty is that there's uncertainty. So I'm working currently on an article that's is exploring the idea of uncertainty as a new competence.
What is there such?
I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, well, no. It does. I'm curious as to whether there's such a thing as a toolkit, because it's one thing to get to come to therapy. We were talking about the worried well. It's also very expensive, and it's the well off often who can access private therapy anyway.
Yeah.
Is there a toolkit that you carry for yourself as a means of making the most of what you've learned through your work? Is there a toolkit we can all carry? And if so, what are some of the main things in it?
Yeah. I'm sorry to disappoint you, Catherine, but I'm going to say there isn't a toolkit, in the sense that, and again, this is different. You know, I do appreciate other therapists do promote the idea of having a toolkit. I think the toolkit, as it were, to use that image, is yourself. Is the person. So you know, I mean I can tell you how I managed my, you know, sort of say a certain level of anxiety or nervousness or whatever about, you know, being interviewed, and, you know, that I took a break and I did some breathing and I, you know, made sure I was prepared and then took an hour off and had a cup of tea and went in the garden and, you know, phoned a friend, you know, but those are more, you know, I don't see those as part of a toolkit. They're sort of what I need to do in order to self-regulate. And I think, again, it comes back to the relationship. My way of doing therapy is unique to the individual client. So what I do and how I work with one client is different from another client because they're different and the relationship is different. I think all the training that I have done, and I'm an advocate, obviously, as Professor of Psychotherapy at Auckland University of Technology, I'm an advocate for psychotherapy training, and I'm, you know, professing psychotherapy. But I think all the training that we do, or the education that we do, essentially is about us as therapists being able to hold ourselves in relationship in relationship to any particular client, you know, whatever they're presenting. So it's more of a personal training than a toolbox training.
You mentioned
earlier. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It does. You mentioned earlier, you alluded to different cultures and different traditions as a means, way predating the 20th century, sort of classic schools.
Yeah.
Do you see, clearly as a reasonably new New Zealander, a decade, I think, do you see things already within Māoridom and within tikanga Māori that dovetail with the sort of academic and professional background you've had? And are we seeing a bit more openness to drawing from each other's traditions and disciplines and cultures, or still very stuck in a sort of an academic process that prevents that happening, I guess?
Wow, that's a lot of there's a lot of questions and probably a lot of answers in there, and probably a few more questions in there. I think you're right. I am a relatively new, well, I will be a relatively new New Zealander because I've just applied for citizenship, although I've been here 11 years. We sort of never quite got around to it, but it's one of the benefits of lockdown. We've sort of gone through the in-tray and applied now. So we're looking forward to being New Zealanders. But I certainly feel very passionate about being here and living here, and this is my permanent home now. And I think I'm still learning a lot about Te Ao Māori. I have, much more to learn.
I guess the comparison I would make is that we've seen in physical medicine a gentle openness towards some more kinds of, in the case again of Māori, of rongoā Māori, or in some, same also again, some very long-standing Chinese traditions as well, where they've sort of had their own clinical trials due to a 5,000-year history, right? So we're beginning to see a little bit of a more open mind about what different cultures can bring to a discipline.
Yeah.
Is there a difference, though, between the professional discipline that is psychotherapy and perhaps just a more openness towards different practices or approaches? Yeah. Is there a bit of a line when it comes to the formal practice of a therapy that prevents a greater incorporation?
Well, this is a really contemporary debate. I mean, I suppose, first of all, I'm not sure how open, you know, Western institutions are to what would be seen as alternatives. So, for instance, I don't think that there is a rongoā Māori course at any of the what I would call Western universities rather than the Wānanga. As far as psychotherapy is concerned, I think there's sort of good news and bad news. I think that the profession of psychotherapy in Aotearoa has been quite open in more recent years to the influence of Māori members and even Māori practitioners outside of psychotherapy. But I think that's still partial and patchy. Mm. And, you know, the idea, again, I'm just writing an article with a Māori colleague and a Pacifica colleague about racism in psychology, and there's a lot of resistance to a curriculum that would really be based profoundly on tikanga Māori, mataranga Māori, and so on. And so I think that sort of leads to a situation which is not uncommon overseas, where people who are in the minority or outside the profession, you know, do study sort of a Western form in order to qualify, and then, you know, practice maybe using their own, ideas. And I personally would like to see much more dialogue. I don't want to even say integration, because integration can often be incorporation.
Sure.
I'd like to see much more dialogue and respectful engagement and, you know, parallel pathways or integrated pathways and so on. But for that, we also need to appoint more Māori staff. And that also becomes a difficult situation, as I was the last 4 years head of the School of Public Health and Psychosocial Studies at AUT, and managed to appoint 4 early career academics who were Māori and in some cases Pacifica, but that was unusual. So we have a lot more to do.
Keith Tudor there, who won the prestigious International Eric Byrne Memorial Award for his work in the field of transaction analysis. He's New Zealand's only professor of psychotherapy based at the Auckland University of Technology.